From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Let me tell you something about car alarms. They go off accidentally so often, no one pays attention. Today, any car alarm must automatically shut off within 3 minutes. I don't think that's quite fast enough.
You can't stand the noise, but you don't want to move where it's quiet. You love the noise. You hate it, but you love hating it.
There's one thing I hate. All the noise, 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 noise.
And if you haven't figured it out by now, on today's show, we look at noise. More accurately, we listen to noise. We'll explore the history of Japanese noise music and the science of noise. A professional audio engineer will talk about her fear of losing her livelihood, her hearing. And imagine spending 2 days a month without uttering a single word. Anne D. LeClaire will tell us about her days of silence. But first, Noah Vauter is a research assistant and PhD candidate at the MIT Media Lab. He's also the inventor of a portable listening device called Ambient Edition. New York Times describes Vauter's invention as the Ambient Walkman. Ambient Edition consists of a pair of headphones equipped with small microphones and speakers. A tiny digital signal processing chip analyzes the surrounding noises and converts them into a form of music. Noah Vauter explains how Ambient Edition works.
In this case, it really has two halves. You know, one standard model of music might be a combination of harmony, melody, and rhythm. And I found, you know, I did this as a master's thesis project, so for the purposes of the project, it was the most straightforward to implement rhythm and harmonic manipulations initially.
So you take percussive sounds, those are the easiest to deal with, and change the rhythm of them or create a repetitive rhythm using that, a drum bass?
Exactly, exactly. For example, one of the sounds that, at least up here, I encounter most is hand carts, like being unloaded from a truck. Uh-huh. You know, they tend to be empty and, you know, the person pulling them out of the truck tends to yank them and they go bouncing and they hit the ground and just rattle. So that would register in the device as a transient sound. And in isolation, you know, I feel, you know, a lot of this reflects my personal preferences, by the way. So, of course, the field of music is much more broad. But generally, a single drum hit in isolation sounds unresolved. So I'll make a recording. You know, I'm not actually taking the sound, I'm more reflecting it and reproducing it. And I'll put it into a rhythmic sequence so that there's some continuity to it. And it was my thesis that this sort of continuity would be an addition to the surrounding world that makes it just a little more soothing and bearable.
So the initial recording sound would be absolutely recognizable. If you played it, I'd know what it is. But what happens to it then? Does it change in the way you perceive it because it's repeated and sent back to you and put into a different format?
Yeah, and the effects are highly subjective. I will say that for me, at least, they tended to be humorous. And sometimes they play in the space between your memory and what's around you, or even your anticipation, you know, as any music tends to do. For example, one of the very first things I noticed when I was just testing it out, I looked across the street, you know, I put the thing on my head, and I was looking for sounds to hear how they would be transformed. And I was disappointed when I didn't hear a door close processed through the machine. So I took off the headphones, and I watched the door close again, and I realized, like, I couldn't actually hear it anyway. I'd just been sort of anticipating it or imagining it.
Yeah, so actually this is in part the music that's created in your head, even though the machine is sending it to you. You have to participate.
Yeah.
Well, in a way, then, what you're doing is using this device to engage yourself more in the sounds that are around you in the street.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say engage yourself more. Yeah, it wasn't my initial thesis. My initial thesis would be it would, I thought it would put you in contact with things. And I was surprised at the effect of it carrying you in toward yourself. It actually becomes a little more difficult, I believe, to interact with the world. You're essentially distracted by music. Your behavior will look unusual to people.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody these days knows about sound reduction headphones. You get noise that is generated to kind of mask the sounds that are going on around. In a sense, you're doing the opposite. You're taking the sounds that are going on around you and creating something new. And is that what inspired you to create this? What was the idea when you decided that you wanted to try this?
It was to resolve incomplete melodies, what I heard as incomplete melodies surrounding me.
The noises in the street were incomplete melodies to you?
Yes, particularly the brakes of a bus.
Does your algorithm take the musical, I mean, does it look for a pitch in the sounds in the street and then work with that?
I would love for it to, and my whole thesis, the latter half of it is some pontifications about how much further you could go. But for now, it's a little more transparent in its intelligence. It produces transposed versions of what you hear around you, but they're relative. It doesn't have any specific ideas that it seeks for example. I had some original ideas to maybe look for the sound of a police siren, for example, and treat that one specifically, but it doesn't do anything like that.
Of course, you're talking about a tiny device at this point, no larger than an MP3 player, and you can't expect it to compose music, which is, I guess, what I was talking about.
I guess it depends on your definition of music. You know, even as we talk about composing music, we're talking about the listener composing it as they're listening as well. Also with their movements and, you know, their wanderings, they're composing the scene in that way. Other people have written about how conventional Walkman listeners regulate the volume to conform to the experience that they're creating for themselves.
In your thesis, you write that the kind of portable devices we know, the iPods and the Walkman and so forth, create social isolation. Can you explain to me, is that you just mean that people cut themselves off by listening to music instead of having a conversation?
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of the interesting critiques since I've written the thesis have come in that area of the debate about whether acoustic isolation leads to the social isolation. I think there really was a concrete moment in time that I was responding to when I was talking about that. It refers to, believe it or not, September 11th. I realized that there's a sort of palpable mood when you walk down a street. And obviously the mood then was one of mourning. And then since then, I realized that there are other moods. For example, if you're walking down the street and two people are telling a joke and the punchline comes and everybody laughs, then that gives you an indication of the mood of the street and you know it's somewhat of a safety zone. But if you're listening to music, trying to create your own artificial safety zone, then you're one level removed from what everybody else is doing. So, you know, it could lead to increased tension or something like that. So I had the idea that you didn't have to completely remove yourself from what's going on around you. You might still pick up the laughter through the device. And if the laughter comes out in a different pitch or if it's repeated as it's sampled and played as a rhythm, then you may re-experience it several times. So you maintain a little less of a tenuous connection with what's around you.
So I was just thinking about listening to a CD this morning as I was driving into work and laughing my head off at one point. And of course, people in other cars would have no idea what this maniac was doing.
Yeah, it's true. Well, that's sort of one of the fun things about this is when you stop censoring, at least in the context of this is an art project, you temporarily suspend your overt expression of what you're doing. You know, we no longer dance every single time we hear music. Sometimes we just listen as we roll down the street. But this has created at least a temporary kind of inhibition for me and for many people. I mean, they're just funny stories. My favorite is walking around in New York City, just following my ears. I wandered right into the space of a sort of manic street preacher. And everybody else had been maintaining, like I was talking about, that sort of safe distance from the person from using their eyes or responding to the content of his message. And that content through the device is a little bit obscured, what with the rhythms and the transposition and stuff. So I got really close to him before I started using my eyes and looked him eye to eye. And he just handed me one of his business cards and slipped it right into my pocket. And I realized, wow, he could have just slipped my wallet right out with that pocket. There was that. I've caught myself singing along with the thing, trying to hit the notes exactly, because it's got a lot of narrowband filters. So you can sort of practice singing along with it. If your pitch isn't right on, then you might not hear it so well.
Does it affect the way you interact with your environment?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of my favorite papers ever is called Defensible Spaces. And this introduces the concept of an overlay, a visual overlay around all the property and land surrounding you, all the space. It divides it into private, semi-private, public, semi-public, etc. And I think that I, and probably many people, use these as sort of guides to figure out where we're going to go when we're walking down the street. But when you set out to just listen and to take in the variety of sound, then I think your borders are going to be different. For example, I found myself tempted to wander around on neighbors' porches. You know, I'll see a chair up there, and I'll say, like, I wonder what it's like if I just whack that chair with a stick, and I listen to that sound, and I listen to it. Or, you know, I'll touch a fence. You tend to bang things together, you know, make the world into some music concrete.
Noah Vauter is the inventor of ambient addition. Cosco is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California. He has degrees in philosophy, economics, mathematics, electrical engineering, and law. Cosco is also the author of several books, including one called Noise.
Noise is a signal that you don't like. It's any form of energy that you don't like. It's some kind of disturbing information or outside source. And a signal is itself a form of energy information. So this view of the world is the world consists of energy equals mc squared. And if you like a particular type of energy, you can view that as a signal, like the sound of someone's voice.
Mr. Davalina, Mr. Bob Davalina, Mr. Davalina, Mr. Bob Davalina.
Zilch.
And if you don't like it, you can view that same signal as a noise. For example, that same voice may, in a different context, interfere with the conversation. And just intuitively, it's some kind of interfering signal with whatever it is you're doing. So it has an objective component, the energy or physical side, and a very clear subjective component, whether you like it or not. Fundamentally, one person's signal is all too often someone else's noise, as in the case of you or your next-door neighbor listening to loud music that you or your next-door neighbor doesn't want to hear.
Come on, feel the noise. Girls, rock your boys. We'll get wild, wild.
White noise would be the case of noise where all the frequencies were equally present. Now, that's something we use quite often in the sciences as a model. It's sort of the gold standard of noise. We try to model the hiss and pop sound on a radio, for example, by that. Or if you stand near a waterfall or a fountain, it sounds like white noise. A fan can sound like that, can help you sleep at night. For example, I use a fan quite often to overcome background noise because it approximates white noise. The trouble is that white noise technically does not exist because it would have infinite energy. And that means the noise is going to be colored to some extent, that there's going to be some frequencies more represented in that signal than in others. Pink noise is something that the ear actually hears as white noise. It has a very clear mathematical description, but not so easy to describe it with words. And the other colored noises, brown noise, which arises from Brownian motion type processes. You can certainly view chaos as a form of noise on two grounds. First, it's a form of energy. And second, it's often a form of energy that you don't like. But more deeply, it's a form of energy that statistically looks random. And yet we have simple equations that determine it, just as we do with the random number generator. So it is a kind of deterministic noise, although it has all the footprints of randomness. In fact, it can be made to look like white noise, and you can add it to various systems. But let me say also, in the notion of these colored noises, which are much more difficult to analyze, for example, the physics of the 20th century, coming out of the work of Einstein and others, still largely rests on the assumption of white noise. There's something called the Fokker-Planck, like meet the Fokkers, the Fokker-Planck equation, which is the heart of modern physics on how probabilities evolve in time and how things diffuse. It's fundamentally set up in white noise terms, even though we know the world around us, the physical universe in particular, is very colored noise. And that means there's correlations. And in some cases, those correlations can be far-reaching at times. There have been theories alleged, I discuss these in the book Noise, that the fossil record, for example, of Earth, looked at over hundreds of millions of years, exhibits pink noise. And say, well, how could that be? What would be the correlation effect that far in time? We don't know, but if you plot it out mathematically, you can make a plausible case, not a convincing case, but a plausible case, that the fossil record, some fossil records, is well described by a pink noise model, or what's often called a power law. So colors run deep in the noise spectrum, and the easy statement is, as a practical matter, all noise is colored. But if you open up the textbooks of science and the way scientists are taught, it's almost always white noise. It's much easier to work with. It's a convenient mathematical fiction. And again, it in many cases holds quite approximately. For example, the thermal noise in the room you're in right now, we know from quantum mechanics that looks a lot like white noise ought to look, but it still varies a little bit at the edges. But for a lot of practical purposes, whether it's a computer chip or the use of your cell phone, you can go ahead and model that as white noise. To me, the big surprise about noise is that it may be the secret of life. It may be the motive force, that animating force that makes cells move. At the very heart of the cell, and your body consists of trillions of cells, in the mitochondria, you have a lot of proteins coming and going. How does that happen? What's the motor structure? Well, it appears that a lot of them hitch a ride on the inherent fluctuations in the noise at that level, the quantum level. It's not a free lunch, because then you'd have a perpetual motion machine. And so certain cells, certain proteins, seem to, each time they walk, harnessing a bit of local energy from noise, have to burn up a molecule of energy. It's called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. So it's not a free lunch, but it appears that nature found a way to make proteins move with noise, to exploit that. Besides the fact that they also had to find a way to move through noise, but actually to exploit that. So in some sense, it looks like, at the biochemical level, that noise, again, it's controversial, but there's a lot of evidence that supports this among biochemists, that the motive force in a lot of what are called protein motors turns out to be inherent noise in the world. That the thing that Einstein showed back in 1905, when he was busy doing relativity and other things, he also showed in that famous year for him, that noise has a certain mathematical structure. And indeed, the mathematical structure he proposed is the same kind of models of noise that we use in the financial markets, for better or for worse. It had a profound effect. But that diffusion kind of noise taking place at the cell level seems to charge life with motion, if not to create life. Now, it doesn't mean it's the secret of life, but it sure smacks of it. And it's hard to imagine how life as we know it would have occurred without that kind of noise.
Bart Kosko is the author of Noise. Is noise a problem in your life? Are there certain noises that drive you crazy? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, the rattle and hum of Japanese noise music, and an audio engineer's worst nightmare, losing her hearing, as we continue to explore noise. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Paul Hegarty is a lecturer in philosophy and visual culture at University College Cork in Cork, Ireland. Hegarty's also the author of Noise Music, A History, where he makes the case that the Japanese are central to the history of noise music. Hegarty told Steve Paulson about his introduction to Japanese noise music.
It's in Nottingham in the UK in 93, I'd say. And I look at this beautiful album called Anti-Monument by Mertzbo in a cardboard, very long cover with stuck-on pictures of planes and things falling apart.
Mertzbo is a Japanese noise musician.
Right, it's the working name for a guy called Masami Akita. And I got that home, and it was just banging and clattering and noises. This is good. Are you allowed to do this? So at a personal level, it was my way in to another level of strange music, way beyond the kind of industrial music that was then in vogue, like Ministry and Nine Inch Nails and so on. Then it turned out there's tons of this stuff out there, and the 90s saw a huge explosion. So I'm going to work backwards. I'm going to start with the 90s. The 90s is when it really became a sort of pure thing, where Mertzbo gets louder and louder. The rock bands like Keiji Hino's, Fushitsusha, bands like The Ruins start in the 90s. And there's this drive, kind of like an arms race towards extreme volume and extreme content at the same time. Prior to this, we can go back as far as the early 70s to kind of the arrival of free jazz, prog rock. I suppose those are the main ones into Japan, and heavy metal, right. So Mertzbo's favourite music is Black Sabbath and King Crimson, for example, and a lot of jazz. So what they were doing, and a lot of the musicians would kind of say this, is that for them, they didn't divide this music up into different genres. They were reading it as a different type of information. A problem is often raised of those of us writing about music in the West, that we're somehow reductive of another culture, in this case Japan, and maybe it's not all noise to them. And that's possibly true. But a certain level of reduction is not possible to avoid, and the Japanese musicians in the 70s and through the 80s were processing whole swathes of new Western music, very occasionally combining it with Japanese traditional music, but very occasionally, and sort of producing this sort of, well, why don't we just have more of this? Why don't we make the tracks longer? So Acid Mother's Temple, who do a lot of touring in Europe, so they turn up here at least once a year, they basically sound like Hawkwind, but they're a lot louder. Every song is 25, 30 minutes or 25, 30 seconds long. So that would be a kind of typical strategy. They're not the noisiest, they're just rock music, really. But that's the kind of thing that was happening in the 80s, was taking every kind of genre and mixing them together, or perhaps stretching them.
Well, and then Mertzbo does some rather interesting things. I mean, for instance, in some of his pieces, he incorporates nature recordings into his music. I'm thinking, for instance, of the song Black Frog. What do you think he's trying to do there?
Well, I'm always trying to work out whether he has or hasn't incorporated them. There's a Seals album, which I'm pretty sure has Seal sounds in. There's a very good album that's come out at the end of last year called Dolphin Sonar. Well, for him personally, the bizarre thing for this music, which is essentially just kind of all the way through, is that he thinks this is political. So how is he doing that? That's the real curiosity to me. So in Dolphin Sonar, or the Frog one that you mentioned, the Seals album, there's other ones about others see wildlife. Just to have them in the titles and to get people thinking, I think the noise music creates a space for people to reflect on that without directing the way in which you think. Now, sometimes on the cover it will say, this is how to get in touch with PETA or Organizations Against Whaling or this kind of thing. So there is that side of it. But for example, on Dolphin Sonar, which I presume is about dolphins being misled by too much shipping going on, it's about them being caught in nets in tuna fishing, but it's also about the possibility of them having their own system of sonar. Well, if you listen to the actual music, it's hard to tell whether this is supposed to depict the terrible time dolphins are having, or is this the beauty of nature? So firstly, you get the space to think about that. Then you're trying to read for content. You're saying, well, what's he saying about the frogs? What's he saying about the dolphins? Well, we don't really quite know what the answer is there. But overall, you get this nice, pleasing effect, I think, of awareness of the kind of random and incredible, exuberant creativeness of nature. So you get a very positive image of nature, I think, out of the sort of endless chaos that he's happy to put in front of us.
Because I would think that almost by definition, we would say that nature itself cannot create noise. Noise is something that only humans can create. Would you say that's true?
Largely, although my cat George might disagree. He was very helpful. I don't think I referred to him in the book in the end. Maybe I did. I was listening to an album by a female Japanese performer, Sachiko M, which is basically sine waves and silence. And, you know, George can listen to anything. He's been brought up in a noise environment. And I was sort of taking notes and going, oh, there's another silence. How long is that silence? And he was going mental. Aha! Thank you, George. It's not silent. It's only silent to me. So he would slightly disagree. Largely, though, yes, noise is some kind of judgment. So you need a system of meaning. You need systems of language with which to compare the thing you're calling noise. But I would think, pushing it slightly, but in a way consistent with Mertzbo, I would think that any animal that has worked out a system of sound processing has things it regards as noise, and noise would be the threatening things, like a hunting animal or something.
Mm-hmm. It was part of Mertzbo's project to subvert our ideas of what music is. Is he creating an anti-music, but yet somehow it's connected to music as well?
Yeah. Right, okay, I'll go on. Tempted to, that was basically the answer with a question mark on, is what you gave me there. I think initially he was much more interested in that. It is an anti-music in the same way that the Dadaist Hans Richter wrote his book about Dada and called it Art and Anti-Art, and had the idea of anti-art as being something very positive, something that was a bit like art, that happened where art was happening, but was actually an attack on our ideas on art. So Mertzbo is doing that, for sure. But I think increasingly as he's gone on, it feels to me as a, for him, for the audience that is now used to this being out there, and for me as well, like wherever you want to place this, it's more a case of a parallel universe. Like this is a different world where music started out differently, where it didn't have the conventions. So I'm increasingly thinking in those terms of parallel sound universes, parallel ways of constructing meaning, which brings us back to the first thing you were saying about, you know, some people think free jazz is structured and others wouldn't, for example.
Now, Mertzbo has been called the most important artist in noise music. Would you agree with that assessment?
Oh, this is another yes moment. He's untouchable, I think, will be for a long time because of the volume, that's sort of a pun, I suppose, tragically, the volume of stuff that he brings out, which is, it's really hard to keep track of. It's well over 200, maybe it's 250 releases. He's doing 13 for one label this year. Important records, I think that is. So you still get, I have many, I don't know how many albums I have of his, but there is still a kind of, the threateningness has gone away, but you're still not quite sure what to get, even with small variations like using a laptop or compared to analog sources or field recordings or there are more musical kind of feels. I mean, I was slightly disappointed. I saw him for the first time last year at a festival in Birmingham playing with KG Hino, and it was relatively tranquil. And then he just got behind the drum set and played the drums while KG Hino bashed away at guitar. I was thinking, this is good, but it's not quite what I was after. So tragically, you get this weird thing that Mertzbo is always ahead, challenging everyone's expectations. And then you get the Noise listener going, yeah, actually, I just wanted that blasting thing that I like.
Now, at the very end of your book, you talk about the difference between hearing and listening. What's the distinction?
Within sound art, John Cage has taken and Pauline Oliveros as kind of pioneers of listening, that, you know, this is a great democratization that we should all, if we're all listeners, we're all artists and the whole world becomes artistic. And I think, right, that's good up to a certain point. But what it's also doing is conveying control to us over our environment, control over the sound environment. So to assert that listening is the most important implies that you're in a position to do the listening. And once you've done that, once you put yourself in a position, you can kind of stay in charge of it. Hearing, on the other hand, is what happens when you're more kind of subjected to music. Now, that could well be listening to popular music in a public location, one of the sort of non-spaces that we spend a lot of time in the contemporary world, or it could be some selected Japanese sound or whichever. But either way, something about it should not stop you listening, but make you alternate between listening and hearing so that you were doing something with it mentally rather than just turned into a vegetable. But, well, that would be interesting too. It kind of only would work once. It's a sort of one-way direction idea. So alternating between them, I think, is the interesting thing. And the simple answer is listening is logically processing sound, and hearing is the sound kind of being more active in its own right.
Paul Hegarty is the author of Noise, Music, A History. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of noise music? Is it a form of music? You can share your thoughts with us by sending email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Carol Owen is the technical director of To the Best of Our Knowledge. She's the one who makes our show sound so good. Carol's been a professional audio engineer for 30 years, and throughout her career, she's thought a lot about noise.
Noise was always the enemy. From those first Golden Book records on my little pink and gray record player, I learned you had to listen through the noise for the signal. Then came cassettes, high school. I'd lie there in bed at night waiting for my new favorite song, cheap mic pointed at the clock radio speakers, fingers poised on the record and play buttons. Maybe through the room noise, the radio static, and the cassette tape hiss, I might be able to hear that song again whenever I liked. By the 1980s, the music business was huge. Recording studios were incredible, sophisticated palaces of cutting-edge technology, and I was in the middle of it, surrounded by playback systems that could cost $100,000 and accurately reproduce any sound. And oh, did we give them a workout. When you know that you can listen back to your rock song at sound levels that would shame a jet engine, why wouldn't you? But there was still a noise problem. Analog tape hiss. Then one evening, Gus from Sony showed up at the studio with a new technology, music recorded digitally on a beta video recorder. He played an as-yet unreleased track to demonstrate what he called digital black. It was a revelation. No hiss. No noise. The huge, expensive analog tape machines huddled in the corner. Dinosaurs listening to that asteroid fall. At about this time, my mom began to accuse me of mumbling. "Speak clearly," she'd say. "I can't understand you if you don't speak up." She'd mention ringing sounds in her ears, dizzy spells when her sense of balance would be disturbed. It would always pass after a few seconds or a minute. "When you get a ringing in your ear, someone's talking about you," she'd say. "If it's in your right ear, they're saying something nice." More and more, though, my father and I always seemed to be mumbling when we talked to her. I started to get concerned about noise and started researching. Tinnitus, it's called. Tinnitus, tinnitus, however you say it, it's noise. Noises inside your ears. Ringing, crackling, roaring, whooshing sounds that accompany the heartbeat. Echoey, distorted sounds that can make conversation impossible to understand. Tinnitus can be caused by prescription drugs, by caffeine, by trauma. It can be caused by long-term exposure to really loud sounds. That gave me pause. It can be inherited. Great. In the big genetic crapshoot, did I get my father's teeth and my mother's ears? People with really severe tinnitus get depressed, even suicidal. Oh, and one more thing. There are treatments, but there's no cure. For an audio geek, tinnitus would be a career killer. I used to think that as one became hard of hearing, sound faded away, like turning the volume down until only the loudest sounds were still perceptible. I imagined Beethoven scowling as he tried to hear the faint sound of the orchestra playing triple fortissimo. It had never occurred to me that it wasn't silence that obscured the music, but noise. No wonder he was scowling. Now, when I talk on the phone with my parents, my dad translates everything I say for my mom. "She produced a radio show," he shouts. "They're getting rain and snow," she repeats. They don't go out much anymore. Hearing loss is incredibly isolating. Other people get annoyed with having to speak slowly, clearly, or repeat themselves. Eventually, they stop trying, and so does the person who can't hear them. "The expensive digital hearing aids just make everything louder," Mom says. She can't separate conversation from background sound, the signal from the noise. I haven't the courage to ask her whether what she hears without them is quiet or cacophony. Noise was always the enemy. Noise is what we call the sounds we don't want to hear. But sound. Sound is beautiful. An orchestra's quiet passages, the subtle impact of a snowflake. If tinnitus is my future, will these delicate musics disappear beneath the wash of interference that no technology can dispel? Immersed in an eternity of noise that overwhelms the signal until nothing is left, locked into the clamorous room of the body with no way to escape the noises in my head, no rest from the onslaught? Rest is a respite. In music, a rest is a pause. But Hamlet had it right. The rest is silence.
Carrillo Owen is the technical director for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Coming up, Anne D. LeClaire talks about her practice of total silence on the first and third Monday of each month as we conclude our Hour on Noise. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Anne D. LeClaire is the author of 8 novels, including the critically acclaimed Entering Normal and The Lavender Hour. She's also the author of Listening Below the Noise, a meditation on the practice of silence. The book chronicles LeClaire's experiences spending two Mondays every month in complete silence. She told Anne Strangechamps about her inspiration for her days of silence.
It was 17 years ago, January, and I was walking along a beach near my home on Nantucket Sound. And I was in a great mood. It was a great day, blue sky, just a gorgeous, gorgeous gift of a winter day. And I was sad because my best friend's mother was dying, and I couldn't save her from pain, the pain of that. So I had kind of a tender heart that day. And I was watching two Eider ducks die for food. And they're these small sea ducks that are black and white. And they stayed underwater for so long that it was amazing to me. And I tried to hold my breath as long as they were underwater. And I couldn't. So I was holding my breath, trying to hold it as long as the ducks were underwater. Couldn't do it. And I thought, wow, what an amazing world we live in, that a creature with a lung the size of my finger probably can hold their breath so long. And you know how it is, Anne, when you start to feel gratitude or appreciation for something, it kind of becomes a domino effect. And I thought, well, you know, I'm really lucky to live here in this beautiful place of everywhere I might have landed on the planet. And then I thought, well, I'm really fortunate because I do what I love for a living. I'm a novelist. And then I thought, well, I'm really fortunate that I have a family. And in this particular moment, this day, we're all healthy. And I love my friends. I love my life. And suddenly I was just overcome with a sense of gratitude for everything. And I thought, I am so grateful, I don't even know what to do. And I had tears in my eyes. It was just a moving moment. And in that moment, I heard myself say moving, and it sounded like movie moment, because it was that too. And I heard a voice from outside me, behind me, say, sit in silence. And I turned around because I thought there was someone on the beach, and there was no one there. And something like that had never happened to me before, hasn't happened since. It was that isolated, but it was real. It was a real voice. So I thought, sit in silence, what does that mean? And I just walked along the beach and kept echoing the phrase, sit in silence. And then I thought, well, maybe it just means shut up. You know, you talk all the time. Maybe just it's time to be quiet. So I went home and told my husband I wasn't going to talk the next day.
And what did he say?
Yeah, you'd think he'd be like, oh, great. But he was like, well, no, you can't do that. What if the kids need you? We have a son and a daughter. What if Margaret's mother dies and she needs you? And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to try not to talk for one day. And so I woke up the next day, and that began a practice that's gone on now into my 17th year.
I wanted to ask if you'd read a little bit from your book. How about the description you wrote about that very first day of silence, what it was like when you woke up?
Oh, when I woke up? I can do that. Morning, first light, really. Hillary, my husband, lying at my side, already awake. I love you, he said. It felt strange not to respond, and scary, as if I were withholding, keeping a piece of myself apart. Once, as an experiment in mindfulness, I had brushed my teeth with my non-dominant hand for 3 days. As I'd concentrated on this ordinary and automatic act, it felt clumsy and artificial. This new and intentional silence was like that. Everything familiar felt novel and self-conscious. Beneath the blanket, I reached over and squeezed Hillary's hand. He enfolded my fingers with his. I know you do, he said. Our eyes met. How many times over the years had we woken and exchanged words of love? Certainly thousands. But as we lay in early morning light, holding hands and surrounded by stillness, we shared an intimacy that felt new. The night before, I had wondered, actually feared, if cut off from speech, I would feel isolated. Now, lying next to Hillary, I felt especially connected to him, a bond that seemed nearly holy. I thought about how automatic responses, even those of love, could be diminished by familiarity. The novelty of silence awakened what habit had dimmed. This was the first gift. As I stepped into the shower, the upstairs phone rang and I jumped reflexively, and then immediately I remembered I was not talking and had no obligation to answer it. My shoulders dropped and my body released a tension I had not even been aware of holding. Only minutes from sleep, and already my muscles had been primed to meet the day's demands. I thought of the sign at a local breakfast spot that reads, "Good morning, let the stress begin." I realized that we live our days with ears turned outward, ready to respond, always on the alert. almost as if we walked around holding huge ear trumpets to our heads like figures in an old cartoon. But for this one day, both my ears would be turned inward. I had only to listen to myself. Within the shower walls, it felt as if my world had grown smaller and smaller until all that was left was me.
Do you think these years of practicing silence have changed you much as a person?
I do. I think they've been my, you know, I hate phrases like this, but I think it's been my greatest teacher. I mean, they sound so easy to say and kind of flip, but it's true. One of the things, I mean, on one very simple level, is it's taught me to be patient. Again, that most things aren't that important, and something I would feel I'd have to address could wait 24 hours, so it created patience in me. It taught me how to listen.
In your book, you also quote from the Swiss philosopher Max Picard, and he wrote, a long time ago, 1948, wrote, "Nothing has changed the nature of man so much as the loss of silence." I'm curious what, you must have become much more sensitive to how much sound, how much noise surrounds us. What effect do you think the increasing noise in our culture has on us?
Well, I think it's created disease. I think it's created disease in every aspect. I think that it's alienated us from each other. I mean, one of the paradoxes is I thought silence would separate me from others, and in fact, what it's really done is connect me to others because it's changed the way I listen. When I'm in silence, I listen without an agenda. I listen to hear what someone's saying and to hear what's beneath their words. The theologian Paul Tillich said the first duty of love is to listen. And I think silence has taught me how to listen to myself and to others.
What have you heard?
What have I heard? I've heard, take it down a peg, Ann, you're not that important. I've heard that ultimately, if we listen to each other, what we see is we all just want to be seen. We just all want to be seen and heard and valued. And we choose kind of twisted ways to do that. And if we just could come to a neutral place of listening to each other, we can make connections that would have seemed impossible.
You know, I'm listening to you and thinking, I think our lives are full of noise, but it's not all auditory noise. I mean, what about the constant activity, the busyness, the multitasking, you know, the frenetic checking of email and responding to email? All these things can be done in silence, and yet they constitute a kind of noise too, don't you think?
Absolutely. As I say, there's levels of noise and there's levels of silence. There's a stilling of activity, which is a kind of a quietude. There's a stilling of the mind, which is the internal monkey mind being quieted. There's the stilling of pace. I mean, there's a difference between striding out, you know, I'm going for an exercise walk, and actually going for a walk to walk on the land. So there is a stilling of activity, a stilling of mind, a stilling of certainly voice. And this last primary season, listening to the speeches and then listening to the reactions immediately by the anchormen, I thought, whatever happened to time to reflect, to sort out what we actually heard and what it means, and not to react, but to reflect? And so there's that kind of silent space that opens for us to reflect about what we're actually hearing and what we really think about it. When we think about life, I mean, why are we here? How do we want to spend the currency that is our days? All of these things are really important questions to pay attention to. But when we're running and talking and talking and talking, there's no time or space to pay attention to those things.
And why do you think our lives are so full and so busy and so filled with noise, both activity noise and auditory noise?
Well, I think Max Picard was absolutely right. I think technology has changed everything. I mean, there used to be woven into the fabric of our lives meditative moments when we were doing chores, like doing dishes or ironing or raking leaves or mending a fence. I mean, these were all kind of used with hand tools, quiet. I mean, my father used to rake the leaves underneath the maples in the front of our home, and it was a very meditative, and the scraping of the tines on the earth was very meditative, the rustle of the leaves. But now we have leaf blowers, and the decibel level of a leaf blower is 120 decibels, which is the same level as a rock concert or a jet engine on a runway. And that's part of the suburban fabric of our life now. So I think technology has changed it. And I think an inner disquiet has made us kind of frantic in our behavior and pursuits. And we've become out of touch and out of tune with meditative time, with quiet time, with being alone with ourselves.
I was thinking of your father raking the leaves and thinking today, if he went out and raked the leaves, he could have an iPod or an MP3 player and, you know, be listening to a podcast or music while he did that. So in some ways, it seems like technology has simply given us many more ways to escape ourselves.
I think that's absolutely right.
But why do we want to escape ourselves?
Well, that's the golden question, isn't it?
What do you think?
I think that we have bought into a sense of self-importance, and we have to stay busy, and we have to multitask. And that was another interesting thing I discovered in the research, was we take a lot of pride in multitasking, but in fact, the brain is hardwired to do one task at a time and do it well. So even though we have trained ourselves to do several things, we're not as effective at any of them because the brain isn't wired that way. I think that we've just lost some sense of peace within ourselves. And I think that theologians and philosophers are probably can talk forever, and people who've studied a lot more about the human psyche to come up with all the theories why. But we are out of touch with the central. You know, we have bought into this idea that to be alive is to be highly stimulated, to have a lot of music going on, to be busy, to follow addictions. But to be authentically alive means to be at peace with yourself and at one with the world.
Anne D. LeClaire is the author of Listening Below the Noise, a meditation on the practice of silence. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 329B, The Art of Noise. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.